Good evening, everybody, and welcome to RCR 360. My name is Alistair Harding, and tonight on the show, we've got a very special pop culture reference to make, and it involves Fonzie from Happy Days. You see, when I was a kid, Happy Days was loved by everyone. But there was a moment towards the end of its life when, in an attempt to raise its flagging ratings, Fonzie got on a pair of water skis and jumped a shark. It was a moment of absurdity when everyone realized things had gone too far, and thus the cultural reference of jumping the shark, meaning someone's overstepped. And it's that reference that I use now for the subject of fluoride that we're talking about tonight on RCR 360. Because on the 12th of February, the New Zealand media and the government jumped the shark when they suggested that councillors in Whangarei, who are representing their residents, might face prison time if they continue to question the fluoridation edict that their community doesn't want. I'm not kidding. Despite the stone-cold fact that the law in this fluoridation case does not say anything about imprisonment, the Northern Advocate newspaper printed that unnamed lawyers had suggested councillors were at risk of imprisonment as a result of the council not fluoridating. This is where the managerial class that now runs this country has got to, where they think that democracy is about telling everyone else what to do and then threatening them with imprisonment if those orders aren't followed. Let's be clear, the Whangarei Council is not breaking any law. They've been ordered to do the fluoridation by a certain date, and they're using the time between now and then to explore every option available to them in order to satisfy the wishes of the community they serve, who don't want fluoride in their drinking water. And that's democracy in action. What's not democracy is a newspaper spreading misinformation, or unnamed lawyers threatening public representatives with laws that don't exist. But what's most egregious in all of this is that it happened while US attorney Michael Connett was in the country, because Michael Connett is the lawyer who took the science of how fluoride in our water affects the brains and bones of us all to a federal court where it was tested against all the known knowledge of those who think it's the greatest community medical intervention in history. And he won, proving that there is no safe level of fluoride in our water supplies. And I would argue that that makes him the world's biggest expert on the dangers of fluoride, because he had to prove it, and he did. But furthermore, what he proved was that the science actually hasn't changed. He showed conclusively, and you'll see it here tonight on RCR as well, that there never was any science. And so that's why this case of false threats of imprisonment is even more egregious, because he was in the country when all of this went down, doing a tour of the North Island, speaking to hundreds of people wherever he went. And instead of going to him and availing themselves of the opportunity to talk to the world's foremost expert on the dangers of fluoridation, the media chose to instead reprint a misrepresentation of the law by unnamed lawyers, in an obvious attempt to intimidate the representatives of the people of Whangarei. So tonight on RCR 360, Marie Buskey and I are going to share with you the side of the story that you weren't told. We have comments from the Whangarei mayor and a councillor from Rotorua who's also questioning the orders to fluoridate. But biggest of all, we have an exclusive interview with the man himself, Michael Connett, who gives us his insights into the reasons why community water fluoridation is not just indefensible, but it's also on the way out. That's all coming up right after Marie gives us the rundown on what's been happening on RCR this past week.
Thanks, Alistair. It's been a huge week on RCR. We've covered the stories and the perspectives you won't hear on New Zealand's corporate media, challenging narratives, asking the tough questions, and giving a voice to the conversations that matter. From politics to free speech to media bias, health and rural issues, let's take a look at what's been making the headlines. This week, we've tackled major political shifts, media spin and legal battles, bringing you the insights and analysis missing from the mainstream. Canadian MP Kevin Vong joined Simon O'Connor for a fascinating chat about Trudeau's looming resignation, Trump's growing influence, and the bigger global picture. What does it mean for Canada, New Zealand, and the world stage? The This one is a must listen. Liz Gunn's lawyer Matthew Haig spoke to Paul Brennan about her airport assault case, how a simple touch escalated into a legal storm. And Brian Tamaki sat down with Rodney Hyde to discuss the Man Up protest at Auckland Pride and whether this movement is a bold stand for free speech or fueling further division. And on free speech, the fight for free speech and fair media coverage continues. This week, I had a great conversation with Simon Anderson, where we unpacked the media inconsistencies and the growing public distrust in mainstream news. We looked at the protests led by Destiny's Church and the potential consequences of exposing children to these kinds of public events. We also tackled the handling of the death threat against Posy Parker by New Zealand police and why the same legislative trends seem to be appearing across the Western Hemisphere nations. Independent media is growing for a reason, and people are looking for the truth. On Media Matters, Marty Gibson and I dive into how media is pushing political and ideological narratives, omitting the key facts and just dumbing down stories. Looking for good news content today in legacy media is like being a prospector panning for gold. It's really hard to find those nuggets. So if you're tired of the spin, you don't want to miss this one. I'll be back at the end of the show with a further roundup of what's on RCR this week, including where to find further stories on fluoride, farming, finance, and more. Back to you, Alistair.
Okay, thanks for that, Marie. That's the rundown for this week from Marie Buskey. And Marie joins me now. Hello, Marie. Welcome to the show.
Hi, Alistair. How are you?
I'm very good. We're talking about fluoride, and it really feels like there's a change in the air at the moment. It really feels like something's happening on this one.
Yeah. Don't you feel like that you're on the precipice of something monumental? The timing is just deliciously perfect, I think, for all of this. And I think it's just the beginning of many more questions, answers, discussions, debates, the length and breadth of the country. And this is just a tip of a very, very large iceberg.
One thing that I've learned out of this fluoride debate is I'm learning a new respect for democracy, quite frankly, because for a long time, the people that have been fighting community water fluoridation have been shut up. They've been ostracized. They've been smeared in the media and so on. But they've been keeping on giving their view over and over again. And I'm talking about people like Fluoride Free NZ. And in particular, I'm talking about Kane Titchener and Mary Byrne. I know there are others in Fluoride Free NZ, but I don't know them, so I'm including all of them in this statement. But, you know, they have just kept on talking and talking and talking, and finally they're starting to hit pay dirt, aren't they?
Yeah, they are. They are. They're getting cut through. You know, and it's something that takes us back to episode one that Jeffrey Tucker said to us. That was that Steve Bannon quote, what humans make, humans can unmake.
Yeah.
And I think this has been the case here. You know, the councils and local governments and the national governments have gone and created something, and the people are now starting to uncreate it. And it doesn't happen overnight. It does take a long time. It does take persistence. And there have been some real campaigners with this that have been persistent. And that, I guess, is how democracy works. Sometimes you have the kernel of an idea, it needs to germinate, and then you need to fertilize it, and then it needs to flourish. And I think we're in flourishing now.
One of the reasons why I think that we're about to see a change is because the mainstream media over the last couple of weeks have started reporting that the Whangarei District Council, who are fighting this and asking for a day in court over the fluoridation of their water supply, they're starting to suggest that the Ministry of Health are threatening them with jail time. I find this absolutely amazing. And I think it's also a sign that perhaps they've lost the argument.
Yeah, and also too, I think that there is a laziness and a complicitness from our national, like our centralised government, that they have complete and utter control, whereas local governments should be able to make decisions for their constituents. And, you know, there was a huge push for centralisation with the Ardern administration, and that hangover is still there now. And I think it's I think that power is intoxicating.
Well, I think it's also a sign that they've just gone too far now, that power has gone to someone's head. And I mean, are we still living in a democracy? Are we seriously suggesting people should go to jail for advocating for what they want in their drinking water? This is ridiculous.
Yeah, it is ridiculous. And the fact that Dr. Savati even mooted that is incredible. I mean, why on earth would she play such a lever in doing that? And then all of a sudden, once that is done, she's poof, she's gone.
Well, do you think the two are connected? Because to me, I look at statements like that, the way that that got into the media, and nobody's really taking ownership of the statement. They're just saying, oh, lawyers are saying this and so-and-so's saying that, and these counsellors could be facing jail time. So nobody's really wanting to take ownership on it. But then very soon after, Safadi's out and she's leaving, not in 3 months, she's leaving in 1 week.
Yeah. Look, if I polish my tinfoil hat, I would say yes. I don't know. I wasn't in those meetings. I don't know her thought process on this. But there is, I think, a case of they've had it. It's been one-way traffic. They've had it their own way for such a long time. They've not come up against any opposition. They've not come up against democracy. They've not come up against people actually putting their hands up and saying, no. People have discovered their no now. And it is really encouraging. We're seeing it in Whangarei. We're seeing it in your home patch of Rotorua. Tauranga are there, but Mahi Drysdale is a little bit like Christopher Luxon. He needs to find his gonads. They've gone AWOL for a bit. There are multiple, Marlborough, another one. I saw them in the press. They're actually being preemptive. They're getting out there and letting their councils know exactly how they feel. This is democracy in action. That's exciting. But I guess when you have been in centralised power for as long as some of these people have, and everyone has said yes to you and you've had no opposition, coming up against some headwinds like this must be daunting. And I think it got too hot in the kitchen for her and she got out.
Okay, so to give our viewers an idea of who is standing up to central government at the moment and saying no, Paul Brennan spoke to the mayor of Whangarei, Vince Kokorulo, and we'll just play a little bit of his clip now and we'll come back and talk about it. This is Vince Kokorulo talking to Paul Brennan.
The demands from the Director General of Health, it's been reported, I'm going to bring up just a fraction of a news story from the Herald here to drive this point home. Whangarei District Council is risking imprisonment for its politicians as it continues to defy the government fluoridation order. Lawyers have warned. We had Winston on. Winston said, don't blame the Director General. They are compelled to do this by law. And I'm sure he has a point there. But the heavy-handedness and the risk of imprisonment, really?
Yeah. Well, these are the things that we've heard as well. At the end of the day, we've broken no laws. So, you know, we can't be imposed of anything if we've broken no laws.
So how come it's an issue then? Haven't broken any laws.
That's exactly right. And that's exactly what we keep bringing up. If we've broken no laws, people can, I use the word threat, but people can say this is what they're going to do. Yet if we've broken no laws, there's no real point in proceeding any further. It's one of those things that people in certain positions do from time to time. I still come back down to it. You need to have a court of law to determine what's actually safe and what's not safe. And that's truly what it needs to be. So the fact that we've gone around and we've turned around and said, oh, well, these people are saying this and these people are saying this, actually get it to a court of law, get the facts on the table and actually determine what the facts actually are.
Okay, so Marie, that's Vince Kokorulo talking about it. He's saying he wants his day in court. He's saying, you know, it's ridiculous, really, that they should be risking imprisonment. They've broken no laws. All they're asking for is a day in court. What's wrong with that? Why are we even having this discussion about imprisonment?
Oh, I know. It's absolutely ridiculous. But actually, the day in court, I think Cocorello has been so smart. And I think if you listen to the full interview, he talks about how long he's been in council. He's been there since about 2009, I think. He's been in local governance a really long time. He understands his community inside and out. And as he said, you know, they haven't done anything wrong. They have not broken the law. So he, I think it's just so incredibly brave of him to, and with the support of his council, that they're going ahead and saying, no, bring it on. Bring it on, central government. Let's do it.
There's one other part to this little discussion, I think, is that, and that is that Winston Peters also tweeted about this week. And this is what he had to say about it. He said, the Whangarei District Council, being forced to fluoridate their local water supply, is facing a despotic Soviet-era disgrace. This is not a matter of being pro-fluoride or anti-fluoride. It's a matter of what New Zealanders see and value as democracy in this country. It's chilling that we have got to the point in New Zealand where elected politicians are being threatened with imprisonment just for doing their job, standing up for democracy, and asking for a vote, Marie.
Yeah, exactly. Asking for it. And what I love about Winston is he always sees the bigger picture. And this is the bigger picture. As he said, a Soviet era.
A despotic Soviet era disgrace.
A despotic Soviet era disgrace.
To me, what it says is actually that they've run out of arguments. The science is out there. We're going to be talking about the science a little bit today because we have an interview with Michael Connett, the lawyer from the United States, who has actually taken the science to court and had it tested, and he won. He took the EPA, the Environmental Protection Agency, to court in the United States, and the judge sided with the science, which says that fluoride is a neurotoxin, that it harms brains. So we've got an interview with Michael. He's just been in New Zealand as a guest of Fluoride Free NZ. He's been doing a tour all around New Zealand. And I got to sit down and have a chat with him. So we've got an interview that we're going to play in two parts a little bit later on. What he came, the message that he came to New Zealand with, is that there is no science showing that fluoride is safe and effective. And what's more, there's science showing that it is actually dangerous. And I feel that this move by the Ministry of Health, by the Director General of Health, by the New Zealand media even, to try and threaten these councillors with jail time for simply standing up and saying, we don't want it in our water supply, can we please at least talk about it? I find that that's probably the last chance saloon, isn't it? That's the place where they're saying, hey, we don't actually have any more argument. We're just going to threaten you now.
Yeah, it is. Yeah, it is definitely. This is the final resort. But I think this is also good because it means they back themselves into a corner. They've got nowhere else to go. And they're literally standing there in the corner with their pants down. So, I mean, it's
another place that is pushing back at the moment is Rotorua. And we've got a little clip here. This is Conan O'Brien. He's one of the Rotorua councillors. These are his thoughts.
I personally am very concerned that a new minister would come in, make statements as what I believe he's made to the press on our
motion. That is that he supports it. He supports fluoridation, doesn't he? He's quoted as...
Well, sorry, from what I understand from our local newspaper, the Rotorua Daily Post, if I may quote Paul, said that they contacted him, or certainly his office, about the motion and if it would be considered, what his powers were, etc. And sorry, if I can quote from them directly. Brown confirmed the government stance remained the same and that community water fluoridation was a safe, effective and affordable measure for improving oral health. Now, we should all take oral health very seriously, and I do, but for me, this is, and I'm only speaking personally here, I won't speak for my other councillors or who worship the mayor, this is very lazy policy. This whole, well, sorry, here's an issue here, so we'll just medicate everybody. We're not really sure how this will affect locals or how this will affect certain determinants, environmental factors, but also our pristine lakes. Now, we've been beset throughout our lakes with algal blooms of various strengths. It's a very deep concern to me to know if this ends up in our lakes eventually, which, you know, wastewater always does, even treated, what's the effects long-term on our kura, on our local species? What's the local effect on fish caught over a period of time? So this, for me, is why I was hoping that the inquiry would look at all these aspects, certainly from a New Zealand perspective.
Okay, so what are your thoughts from that one, from Conan O'Brien, Marie?
Yeah, he makes a lot of good points, and particularly the one around lazy policy. There's a lot of, we talked about lazy policy and poor policy writing last week with the GE Free debate. This is absolutely no different. There is a, they're wanting to maintain the status quo. There is lazy policy there. And the fact that Simeon Brown has come in, still supportive of all the measures, he doesn't want any change. And all Rotorua is saying is, hey, look, you know, we need to look into this. We need a full inquiry, not only for the health of our constituents here in Rotorua, but also too for the environment. So I think what he's asking for, you know, as a councillor and mooting is actually perfectly reasonable.
This is another reason why I do think that fluoride's on the way out, because people are starting to broaden the scope a little bit. They're starting to understand all the nuances of the whole thing. He's not just talking about children's health. He's also talking about the damage to the environment. And that shows a broadening of the knowledge base, doesn't it?
Yeah, it does. It does. Because let's face it, where do they source the fluoride from? I mean, it's a byproduct from the industrial industry. So, you know, they are acutely aware, and especially Rotorua. I mean, you know, it's tourism is its primary industry there, all based around its natural wonders. Of course they want to protect that, and they need to be assured that whatever they're doing does not affect their flora, their fauna, their kōrera, as he said, because that could be devastating for a region like Rotorua. So I think, yeah, again, Conan is actually looking at the bigger picture for both their region, and the central government just are not seeing it.
Okay, and the other part of this discussion is, in the broader view of it all, is this tweet right here that I'm going to put up on the screen right now. This is Robert F. Kennedy Jr. This is just before the election last year, before Donald Trump was elected to the White House. And he was making his voice very clear here. He said, on January the 20th, the Trump White House will advise all U.S. water systems to remove fluoride from public water. Fluoride is an industrial waste associated with arthritis, bone fractures, bone cancer, IQ loss, neurodevelopmental disorders, and thyroid disease. And do you notice there, he has tagged Michael Connaught. Michael Connaught is the subject of our major interview today. We'll be talking to him, so we'll be hearing his views. So we have actually a direct line to the White House, Marie. How good is that?
It is good. And it also just shows how huge this issue is. It's massive.
He talks about the dangers, about how highly toxic it is. And one of the things that I noticed when I was making my In Focus RCR documentary, Fluoride on the Brain, was just incredibly how toxic this stuff is. The people, we have footage there of what the stations are like, where the people are pumping the fluoride into the water system. These people have to wear full hazmat suits. There's a shower, which is right next to them, which if this stuff gets on your skin, that's how quickly you need to wash it off. You can't run across the road to the shower block. You have to do it immediately. That's how poisonous this stuff is. They also use plastic tanks instead of metal tanks because it's so highly corrosive. And I know the argument is from the Ministry of Health. I know the argument is from the Dental Association, all these people, that we have it in such low doses that it isn't harmful. But sorry, I just can't bring myself, or I can't find a way to understand why you would put something so corrosive in something so important as our water supply.
That is the $6 million question. But again, I think it just comes down to someone thought it was a good idea once. They put it in there and then they never updated and went back to the science. And I know Michael talks about that so eloquently. This is the time that sometimes it's easier to maintain the status quo than what it is to listen to questions, listen to objections, and actually change a paradigm. And the paradigm needs to be changed. I mean, the science is there, but then, you know, you go back to Conan O'Brien and his lazy policy. You know, people, they just don't want to make those changes. It's easier to keep things as they are.
Okay, so I think it's probably time now to go to our interview with Michael Connaught. Michael Connaught's the lawyer who took the Environmental Protection Agency, the EPA, to court in the United States, and then he won. But also, I really want to point this one out. As part of that case, the only reason we know how toxic, how neurotoxic fluoride is, how it damages brains and especially children's brains, is because of the release of the National Toxicology Program report into the matter. They were trying to suppress this, and Michael Connett, as part of this case, forced them to release it. This is the man who we would not have that science if it wasn't for him. And I think personally that one day when they make an Aaron Brockovich style film about this topic, Michael Connett's the one they're going to be making the film about. So let's have a look. Here's part one of my interview with Michael Connett.
All right.
Michael Connett is somewhat of a superstar in rooms like this one these days.
I want to take you all on a journey today. The journey of my court case against the U.S. government.
And in rooms like this, it's standing room only.
The EPA, which is the federal environmental health agency that is supposed to protect the public from environmental toxicants.
If you don't know who Michael Connett is, here's the brief story. He's the son of longtime anti-fluoride activists Paul and Alan Connett, who were among the founders of the United States Fluoride Action Network, and who visited us here in New Zealand and helped campaign against community water fluoridation here as well. And so it was in that home environment where the issue of fluoride took hold of Michael Connett's brain. And then he grew up and became a lawyer. And that's when this story led him to here, on this night, in this room, in Rotorua.
I'm an attorney and I love discovery. With discovery, you get to ask big corporations, give us your emails, give us your documents, and put up your officials for deposition. I love depositions, okay?
The reason he's drawing crowds like this so far away from his home in the United States is simple. Our government passed the Health Fluoridation of Drinking Water Amendment Act in 2021, which took the decision to fluoridate water out of local council hands and gave it to the Director General of Health, who then used those powers to order 14 previously unfluoridated local councils to fluoridate their water. And when you do something like that, when you take away choice, what tends to happen is people start researching. And what they found was the work of the lawyer Michael Connett and his case against the United States Environmental Protection Agency. And what he had to say was alarming.
What is the dose of fluoride that is safe for the brain? You have probably heard that there's thousands of studies that prove that water fluoridation is completely safe. Does the NSF have a position on what the upper tolerable daily dose of fluoride that will not cause neurotoxic effects is?
Since we have not conducted risk assessments on any of the fluoridation chemicals, we do not have a position on the daily dose that would be appropriate to prevent or to reduce the risk for neurotoxic effects from fluoride exposure.
As you sit here today, you're not aware of a study that would establish the safety of prenatal fluoride exposure for the brain.
Well, I'm not aware of a study that right now says this dose is safe.
You would agree that this study right here adds further reason why we need to do a reassessment of the fluoride safety standards in the United States.
I think it's a reason for doing not just the United States, I think it's a reason for doing an update to the fluoride assessment.
Everywhere.
Well, for anybody who's interested in fluoride and the need for regulation of fluoride exposure.
Michael Connett's story is the story of the thirst for knowledge, of communities waking up to what's going into our water supplies and growing in numbers too large to ignore. And it's also about a lawyer at the top of his game. And so when Fluoride Free NZ had him come to New Zealand to do a speaking tour, we at RCR 360 got to sit down and talk to him. Welcome to New Zealand.
Thank you. It's great to be here.
So you've been traveling around the North Island, Whangarei, Auckland, Tauranga, Rotorua, Cambridge, and after here you're going Hastings?
Yes.
Palmerston North?
Yep.
Wellington?
Yes.
And how have you been received?
It's been great every night. It's been packed for all of the forums we've been at. So really, and really receptive. And lots of questions, lots of interest. So it's been a really good conversation so far.
In particular, you've also gone and talked to the Whangarei District Council, I understand. How did that go?
It was good. There was, you know, I've spoken with councillors in several areas. There's a lot of concern about both fluoridation, the policy itself, but also the directive from the central government, which is forcing these councils under threat of fine to fluoridate their water. So Whangarei is being told by the Ministry of Health that if they do not have fluoride in their water by March 30th, they will be fined $200,000. And then for every day thereafter that they do not have fluoride in their water, they will be fined an additional $10,000.
I'm guessing that you get contacted by a lot of people all around the world. Have you ever seen or heard of anything like that where a government is putting the threat of fines out there on a local council?
I haven't seen that. You know, I haven't seen that. Now, there's laws in countries that mandate fluoridation, right? So in Ireland, every community that has a certain number of houses connected to the public water supply has to fluoridate, okay? Mm-hmm. So you do have mandatory laws. But this type of situation where you have, you don't have, well, that this kind of like direct head-on conflict between a council that does not want to fluoridate and then the central government saying you must fluoridate, and if you don't by this date, we're going to start fining you. I haven't seen that kind of head-on collision before. And Whangarei is not the only council in New Zealand that is, you know, getting close to that point.
Why is it that I look around and I don't really see a lot of lawyers going after fluoride? You seem to be the only one.
I think the fact that other attorneys haven't really addressed the fluoride issue is kind of consistent with fluoride being a sort of cultural blind spot, which is one of the reasons I was interested in this issue from the beginning. Because when I started reading about fluoride, it struck me that this was like, you know, with pesticides, thankfully, you have organizations that are working to raise awareness about some of the health issues posed by having food with pesticides, right? You have organizations working on genetically modified foods. Thankfully, that's a good thing. We want that. But I found that with fluoride, we didn't have that. And that there was a real need for someone to get involved and really take it on, which I felt I could do. To address that blind spot. And I think my work on, from the legal, you know, working on it, some of the litigation has further sort of filled that gap.
So what did you see that made you want to take this on?
Well, in 1995, a scientist in the US, Phyllis Mullenix, who was at a Harvard-affiliated dental research institute, had published a study finding significant behavioral effects of fluoride exposure in rats. And she hypothesized, based on her findings, that fluoride is something that's likely to affect IQ in humans. You know, her findings were quite significant, but the other aspect of that, which was intriguing, is what happened to her when she published that. She was fired. And so for me, when I got involved, it was clear to me that there was something deeply political about fluoride. And I wanted to know more. I wanted to understand why this was such a forbidden topic for scientists like Dr. Mullenix to publish on.
Okay, so what are they selling here? They're selling us that fluoridation stops cavities.
Well, that's certainly the narrative. There were declines in tooth decay in the areas that fluoridated the water But there were declines in tooth decay in the areas that didn't fluoridate their water. So if you just look at the areas that did fluoridate their water, it's reasonable to think, oh, wow, look, we started fluoridating in the 50s and 60s, and then tooth decay has plummeted since then. You know, water fluoridation did its job, right? And that's the narrative that really dentists in the U.S. espouse all the time, right? But when you broaden the lens and you look at those communities in Europe that didn't fluoridate their water, and if you look at the communities in the United States that didn't fluoridate their water, you see the same decline in tooth decay. So clearly, there was something instead of or in addition to water fluoridation that was causing that decline in cavities.
Okay, so you've been traveling around New Zealand. You've been giving your presentation about your journey with fluoride. And I came to see you the other night in Rotorua. And the thing that I noticed was, the first thing was what I noticed as well when I made my documentary, Fluoride on the Brain, I looked around and I kept being told that there's no evidence that fluoride is dangerous. But there's also doesn't seem to be any evidence that it's good. And I noticed that was a big part of your presentation the other day.
One of the things that you hear when you're involved with campaigns to fluoridate drinking water is you hear things like, there's thousands of studies that have shown that water fluoridation is safe. And some of the more enthusiastic proponents of fluoridation say there's over 30,000 studies that show that water fluoridation is safe. So, you know, I think one of the notable things in my case is I went to these government agencies and I didn't ask them for 30,000 studies or 1,000 studies. I just asked them for one study that, in their view, established the safety of water fluoridation for the brain. And they couldn't point me to one study. And when I asked them, what is the dose of fluoride that is safe for the brain? The dose that you can ingest every day without having to worry that it could have some impact on your brain. Where does it go from safe to toxic, right? They didn't know. No one could give me the dose that's going to be safe for the brain.
Who are you talking to here?
I'm talking to the Food and Drug Administration, the FDA in the U.S., the Centers for Disease Control, the Environmental Protection Agency, and I asked the companies that sell the fluoridation chemicals that are added to water, and I also asked NSF International, which is the organization that certifies the chemicals that are added to drinking water. I asked all of them, what is the safe dose for fluoride that we can have confidence will not harm the brain, like the upper safety, the upper tolerable dose, right? And they all came back saying, we don't have that information. We don't know.
But we're talking about, in here in New Zealand, we're talking about our Ministry of Health. They tell us that there are plenty of studies that show that it's safe.
That's what they say. But at the end of the day, the reality is they don't know what dose is safe.
That's the thing that I noticed, was that they actually haven't done the studies, and they translate that to there is no evidence that it's dangerous. It seems like it's a real twisting of words. It's a twisting of the truth.
Yeah, they're creating the impression that this has been a very well-studied program and they have very clear, compelling evidence of safety. And that's not the case.
Okay, but also when we talk to dentists, or we see the dentists on television whenever they're talking to us about fluoride, and these dentists are sitting there and they're saying, look, you don't have to pull out all these children's decaying teeth. I've had enough of it. I just want the fluoride in the water. It seems like a very impassioned plea for fluoride coming from the dentists themselves.
Well, there's no question that dentists are very impassioned about fluoride. I mean, when you go to dental school, you're generally taught a very one-sided view of this issue, that fluoride is pretty much all good all the time. So it's not quite surprising that you have dentists that very much are strong believers in this policy. But I think when you're thinking about fluoride in the teeth, okay, the first question that you need to ask is, how does fluoride help the teeth?
Okay, how does it?
Topically, not systemically, which is the reverse of what they thought when they started adding this to our water in the 40s and 50s. When they started this program, they believed you needed to swallow fluoride to get the benefit, which is why you add it to water, because you swallow water. But in the decades following the introduction of water fluoridation, there were dental researchers, primarily from Europe, okay, which found this really inconvenient, kind of ugly fact, which is that ingesting fluoride seems to have no real relationship with prevention of cavities, that it's the topical contact of fluoride on the enamel in the mouth that has the benefit, not from the ingestion. The Centers for Disease Control in the United States, which is the most active proponent of fluoridation in the US from the governmental level, they admitted this in 1999. They conceded that fluoride's predominant benefit is topical, not systemic. So that really should have ended water fluoridation. Because if you don't need to ingest this, why are you adding it to people's water?
Well, we've got fluoride toothpaste. That puts it topically on your teeth.
Absolutely.
So what's their argument?
The major argument is that, well, not everybody in society has equal access to dental care. So we need to sort of supplement their exposure to fluoride through the water.
But if I have a drink of water, the water stays in my mouth for half a second before I drink it. How can that possibly be argued that that's a topical application on the teeth?
Well, that's a very good question. How is it that with toothpaste, right, you can't get approval for a fluoride toothpaste in the United States if it contains less than 1,000 parts per million fluoride, okay? So you need at least 1,000 parts per million fluoride for a fluoride toothpaste to be approved in the U.S. And yet, you're adding fluoride to water at about 0.7 parts per million, which is 1,000 times less than that, okay? And you're only having it in your mouth for a few seconds, right? So how does that exposure through the water, how does that provide an effective topical application? It's a good question because I don't think they have the data to demonstrate that that kind of topical exposure is effective.
So Marie, so that's part one of our interview with Michael Connett. Your thoughts?
Oh, yeah, my thoughts. He's so clever and he's a lawyer. And he said in that at the beginning of that clip that he loves being able to go to court as an attorney to get both discovery and depositions, because that's when both sides have to lay everything out on the table and all the information has to be provided. This, I think, is what Vince Cocirullo and those in Whangarei are looking at doing. They're wanting to get all that evidence out on the table and they're wanting to get down in the weeds and have this discussion. So I think it's really smart on their part.
I 100% agree. That's exactly what I'm hearing from Cocirullo as well. And the thing about this is, again, I remember when I made fluoride on the brain, just realizing how little evidence there actually was for fluoride. When you go and look at, say, for instance, I went and looked at the Ministry of Health data on tooth decay throughout New Zealand. And when you put all of that data into graphs, a lot of the time the graphs showed that unfluoridated areas were doing better than fluoridated areas. Now, I know that back in like the 1970s and so on, there was a big difference. But that was before fluoride toothpaste came along. And we all know now, even the Ministry of Health admit and the CDC admit, that it's best put on your teeth topically. Yet they're still trying to push for this, put it in the drinking water and somehow it's going to get into your teeth and protect you. There is just no evidence for it. And I think that's what he's showing. And I think that's what Vince Cocirullo is going to be doing. When he takes this to court, he's going to be taking all of this stuff from Michael Connett and putting it in that court, in those court documents. And I think that that's why they're threatening jail time for these people, because they don't want that information to get into court documents.
No, absolutely not. And I mean, Corin Dan did it, I think, on RNZ when he interviewed Cocorulo. And he was saying, well, what about the impact of low socioeconomic families? Those are the ones, by not allowing fluoridation, you are going to be hurting those people. But here's the thing. Here's the thing with this, right? As you just said, when you did the data dumps, it doesn't appear to be making the difference. I think that this is, again, lazy policy. They have this belief that by putting it in the water that you'll be protecting these people. But in fact, you're actually harming them, because if all that evidence comes out and you're actually putting these most vulnerable communities and you're putting them at the risk of issues with their bones, issues with their brains, you're actually placing them more on the back foot. All for what? A misguided thought that you're going to protect them from getting a filling or two?
Yeah, and look, and it's also ignoring the sugar situation, isn't it? I mean, there's so much science pointing towards sugar as being the problem here, yet they just ignore it.
Well, you brought that up in your documentary with the sugar, is that when they actually look at, traditional Māori diet, those, and they studied skulls from ancient Māori, they didn't have cavities at all, because the traditional diet was protective for their teeth.
For our viewers, that's in the Fluoride on the Brain documentary, which is on the RCR website. Now, what Marie's talking about here is that in the 1930s, the famous physician Weston Price came to New Zealand, and he travelled around New Zealand. He was doing it as part of going around the world, actually, but one of his stops was New Zealand. And he went and looked at the teeth of Maori children who lived eating a Western diet, and also Maori children that were still eating the traditional Maori diet. And the ones eating the traditional Maori diet had no cavities at all. The ones that were eating the Western diet were riddled with cavities. And he also went to the National Museum and he looked at old skulls, old Maori skulls. And out of, I think, a couple of thousand skulls that he looked at, he only found one or two cavities in the teeth. And so it just, to me, it is the point in time when I feel that they talk a lot about the colonization of Maori. Well, this idea about putting fluoride in the water, to me, is the most colonizing medication that you can come up with. At a time when we're wanting to embrace Maori knowledge, this is the perfect time to embrace Maori knowledge. What was it about the Maori diet that meant that Maori kids did not have cavities? I want to know.
Yeah, well, I think a lot of it came down to the fact that they lived an oceanic on the coast, so that you were actually eating a lot of seafood, very high in salt. You're not eating processed sugar at all. I mean, there was, I can't even think, other than berries, I can't think of what any form of sugar would have been available to them at that time. So that actually is part of that sugar story. And we already know through the rates of diabetes, the rates of obesity amongst Māori and Pacifica children, that sugar is a killer. And there's absolutely no reason why you can't look at the dental and link the dental issues with those issues as well. This is around diet, and you're not going to fix it by putting something toxic in the water, thinking this is going to miraculously make things better. I think it's short-sighted. And again, in your In Focus documentary, I think you talked about that what they do in Scotland, which is dental education and providing fluoride toothpaste in the form of topical fluoride, and they're actually starting to see benefits up there. So there are other ways. I think they need to break the paradigm and start looking for something new.
Let's go on to part two of my interview with Michael Connett. In this part, he talks about the court case, which he won against the EPA, and also about the science behind it, the NTP report, also the studies from Canada and Mexico that apply very much so to us here in New Zealand, because our fluoride levels are around the same as those ones there in Canada and Mexico. So let's go have a look at it, and we'll come back and talk about it afterwards, Marie. Okay, so now, your court case. When did it start? Tell me about that.
Well, we filed a petition with the EPA in the fall of 2016, okay? And EPA had 90 days to review and make a decision on the petition. And in February of 2017, the EPA denied the petition, which we expected it would do.
Sorry, what was the petition?
The petition called on the EPA to exercise its authority under the Toxic Substances Control Act to ban water fluoridation on the grounds that this policy poses an unreasonable risk of neurotoxic effects in human beings.
Okay, so they immediately pushed back.
They did. They denied our petition. And then we went to, we brought suit in federal court in 2017. Now, the thing that really attracted me about filing a case like this under the Toxic Substances Control Act is the statute specifically commands that the court not defer to the agency's judgment. So the court is instructed to look at the evidence independently without deference to the agency. So that's very that was very attractive to me, because we have for a long time wanted to have this issue considered by someone or some forum that's neutral and doesn't have sort of a long-standing bias or long-standing axe to grind. So that's why we filed the case.
Okay, so that's 2016, 2017. We're now in, well, it finally got finished in 24. What happened in between? How did it take so long?
Well, a lot happened in between. One of the things that we established was how crude EPA's safety standards are for fluoride. I mean, really remarkably crude, and it will shock most people, okay? And going around New Zealand, I've shown people these deposition clips. And as I show these clips, you can see people are like, there's gasps. People are like stunned by what they hear. Now, EPA is the main regulatory body in the United States that is supposed to protect the public from fluoride in the drinking water, okay? It's their mission, okay? When they established the safe drinking water for fluoride in the 1980s, they only sought to protect us from one health effect of fluoride, and that was a condition called crippling skeletal fluorosis. It is the most severe effect that fluoride can cause on the human body. Okay, it is it's like fluoride causes bone disease. No question about it. Anyone who knows anything about fluoride knows that fluoride can cause bone disease, okay? It causes a spectrum of bone disease, okay? In the early stages, it causes joint pain, joint stiffness, things that are identical to arthritis, okay? No dispute about that, okay? And then as you keep ingesting more and more fluoride, that bone disease becomes increasingly severe, to the point that you have crippling deformities, you have muscle wasting, you have compression of the spinal cord. But the EPA treated that as the, quote, critical effect, meaning the EPA considered that the first adverse effect that fluoride can have on the human organism. Meaning, until you are crippled, you are not harmed by fluoride under the Safe Drinking Water Act. It's the only health effect that they sought to protect against.
Okay, but I've also seen those photos of those people. They're always people from other countries. They're from India or something like that. And that's what our health authorities always tell us. This kind of thing is only ever found in places where they've got fluoride in the water at very high levels naturally. That this doesn't happen in our countries where we fluoridate the water.
Well, crippling skeletal fluorosis has been identified in the United States. But the far more important question is, what about the pre-crippling skeletal fluorosis, which is in many situations, in many cases, indistinguishable from other bone disease that we have in the population, including osteoarthritis. Okay? Government health authorities are making no attempt in the United States, in New Zealand, to understand the extent of fluoride-induced bone disease in the population, to understand how many people have the pre-crippling phase of skeletal fluorosis, okay? Again, we know that excess fluoride exposure can cause joint pain. It can cause joint stiffness. It can cause calcification of the ligaments. Studies show that it causes effects indistinguishable from osteoarthritis. Now, millions of Americans have osteoarthritis. I'm assuming many here in New Zealand have as well. But there's no effort to understand the role that fluoride is playing in this widespread incidence of arthritis.
Okay, so we see that's one place where we'd see it in older people, I would expect. Over the years, it builds up in your bones.
Yes.
For young people, the danger is a little bit different. It's about the brain, isn't it?
That's one of the impacts for sure for young.
And also fluorosis of the teeth.
Right. Millions of children are developing dental fluorosis, which is a mineralization disorder of tooth enamel caused by excess fluoride exposure during the first 6 years of life, mostly. And that will show up as visible staining on the teeth. Actually, dental fluorosis is marked by a subsurface porosity, like the tooth actually has a little bit less tooth mineral than normal. The primary concern with dental fluorosis is it shows that fluoride is causing biological changes in the body. You can see your teeth, right? But you can't see your bones. Mm. And if fluoride is causing a mineralization defect in your teeth, you know, it stands to reason that it could be also causing changes in your bone.
It's an outward sign.
It's an outward sign. And there's a lot of research, very compelling research, to show that fluoride weakens bone and can increase bone fracture rates. And I think that applies to children as well. So I think there is a concern that fluoridation could increase bone fracture rates among children. In fact, there was a study from the US a year ago that reported just that.
Okay, tell me about the brains. Tell me about the kids' brains.
Well, the question of fluoride and the brain first came about from studies in China in the late 1980s, where they found that they actually did studies on aborted fetuses. These studies found changes in the brain that were clearly detrimental and clearly changes that you would not want to see in a developing brain, okay? And that caused concern that, you know, fluoride could be having functional changes, as, for example, with IQ, okay? So in the early 1990s, you see a flurry of studies being conducted in China looking to see whether IQ scores are lower in children who grow up in communities with high fluoride in their water. Yeah. And these studies were showing just that. And that got the attention of at least some scientists in the Western world, okay?
Yeah.
And then, as I mentioned earlier, Dr. Phyllis Mullenix, who was a toxicologist working at the Forsyth Dental Institute, which is a Harvard-affiliated institution, she published an animal study which found that animals exposed to elevated fluoride prenatally in the womb exhibited behavioral deficits after birth. And she was very concerned about that finding and the implications it has for human health. And then from there, you just see like more animal studies being conducted, more human studies being conducted. An important moment in all of this is in 2006, where you have the National Research Council, which is part of the National Academy of Sciences in the U.S. They published an extensive, comprehensive review of fluoride in human health. And in their review, they look at these studies from China, as well as the animal studies. And they conclude, the National Research Council concluded that fluoride does interfere with the functions of the brain. And based on that, they called on the research community to conduct human population studies in the United States and in Western populations to look at whether lower levels of exposure, like we get from water fluoridation, could be impacting neurological health. And they funded what are called birth cohort studies, okay?
Yeah.
And one of these studies was conducted in Mexico City, Mexico, where the moms were exposed to fluoridated salt, which is designed to provide the same optimal dose of fluoride as fluoridated water. And another birth cohort study that the NIH funded was in Canada, where the moms were exposed to fluoridated drinking water, okay? And the studies measured the level of fluoride in the mom's urine, which is a reflection of total fluoride exposure,
yeah.
Okay? And then when the children were born at various intervals, they measured the child's IQ. So in Mexico, they measured the children's IQ at age 4, 6, and 12. And in Canada, they've only measured the IQ at age 4. And then they did an analysis to determine if children's IQ had any association with the level of fluoride in the mom's urine. And in both of those birth cohort studies, there was a significant adverse relationship between the level of fluoride in the mom and the IQ of the child. And to be clear, these studies didn't just look at fluoride and IQ, they looked at the other factors that are known to influence IQ, like parental education, parental income, exposures to other toxic chemicals. So they were very well-conducted, state-of-the-art studies, and they were finding adverse effects of fluoride on IQ at the so-called optimal fluoride level.
And these are the studies that found their way into the NTP report, right? The National Toxicology Program report.
They were in the NTP report and they featured prominently in our trial.
And now I want to talk about that because this is one of the most interesting parts of your story to me, is that we know about the NTP report today, and a lot of people in New Zealand are taking it to the government, to the Ministry of Health, to their councils and so on. The only reason we have that to take to our councils and the Ministry of Health is because of you. You made them release it. They weren't going to release it, weren't they?
That may well be the case. I have to qualify that because I found out in the middle of my trial that report was being held up and may never be released. I was told by someone with knowledge who wanted to remain anonymous that report may never be released.
Key point, may not ever be released.
Right. And once I found that, I immediately began filing Freedom of Information Act requests to obtain all communications related to that report so as to understand what was going on. Why was it being held up? And I was able, thankfully, to actually get emails that showed what was going on.
So what was going on? I mean, why would you stop a report like that, which shows damage to children's brains? Why would you stop that?
Because the Centers for Disease Control, the CDC, which is principally concerned about promoting water fluoridation, saw that report as inconsistent with that goal of promoting water fluoridation. And they worked to convince the Assistant Secretary of Health, Rachel Levine, who is ultimately has authority over the National Toxicology Program, okay? They were able to convince the Assistant Secretary of Health to instruct the NTP to not publish that report. So I was able to get these emails 5 months after that order was given. Okay. And I think, and I then provided these emails to the court. And I think that made it harder for the NTP and the government to just quash the report, because it became an awkward thing for them. Because now, you know, the public knew, the court knew that there was a completed report And why wasn't it being released? And they could see, you know, people could see these emails of the CDC and other dental officials working to prevent the report from being released. Mm. So I think it made it harder for the NTP to bury it.
Okay, what did the judge find? You won this one, didn't you?
We did. After 7.5 years, we got a verdict from the court. And it was an 80-page detailed decision. And the court concluded that fluoridation at the so-called optimal level of 0.7 parts per million poses an unreasonable risk of reduced IQ in children. And based on that finding, the court has ordered the EPA to take regulatory action to address this risk from fluoridation.
And what's the latest on that? Have they done that?
So the EPA, in the last few days of the Biden administration, announced that it will be appealing the court's decision. However, that decision by the Biden administration does not bind the new administration. And so if the new administration wants to take a different approach to fluoride, which Robert Kennedy has made it clear that he wants to take a different approach to fluoride than previous administrations.
Yeah, and look, I think there was a lot of people who got very excited when he announced his intentions on Twitter, and he even hashtagged you. Have you been in contact with him?
I have. I've spoken with Mr. Kennedy about fluoride, and I would certainly welcome further opportunity to discuss the issue with him and to help out in any way that I can if he is confirmed as the secretary.
When we talk to people here in New Zealand, our dental association, for instance, they will say that this was just a district court judge in California. That's not true, is it? This was a federal court judge.
This was a federal court judge. And so that the EPA now has an obligation to take regulatory action, and that regulatory action would apply nationwide. The other thing I would say to those who would seek to diminish the court's ruling on the grounds that it's, you know, this one judge, is that this judge had a very rich source of information available to him. Namely, he had experts on both sides of this issue in not just one trial, but two trials. And he had extensive cross-examination of both sides' experts. And there is a saying that the crucible of cross-examination allows you to get at the truth. Mm. Because people can't just get up there and say I believe this or I believe that and make these pronouncements, because whatever they say, they have to back up with data. Yeah. They have to show the documentation to support their opinions. And so that was so this judge had access to hearing what the full spectrum of expert thought has to say on this. And then each expert was grilled by the other side's attorneys, right?
Yeah.
That's a very rare and unique circumstance.
And as you pointed out at the beginning of this interview, you know, you went looking for that data, and you found that they'd actually didn't have it.
Right. No one got up on the stand and said, water fluoridation, Your Honor, is safe. I mean, we know it's safe. It's, you know, there's, why are we even talking about a potential risk? No one was saying anything like that because they knew they didn't have any competent safety data. It was whether we, the plaintiffs, could prove there's a risk. So so it's a situation where there is no competent safety data on fluoride and the brain, okay? It's not there. If you think it's there, it's not there. The question is could we show that fluoridated water presents a risk to the brain, okay? And we ultimately did because the court agreed there's a risk and it's an unreasonable one.
Okay, but the Ministry of Health here and the New Zealand Dental Association as well, they will say that all of these studies that you're using in that NTP report, they're from places where they have much higher incidence of fluoride in the water. How does that stack up against the studies that you proved your case with?
Well, first off, the birth cohort studies funded by the National Institutes of Health in Mexico City and Canada, those studies involved the so-called optimal fluoride level of about 0.7 parts per million in the water. Okay, so that critique that these are high level fluoride exposures does not apply to those NIH birth cohort studies. Okay, that's the first thing. The second thing is, you know, the NTP's conclusion, okay, which is that fluoride levels of about 1.5 parts per million fluoride in the water is consistently associated with reduced IQ. That finding is very relevant to water fluoridation. And those who tell you it's not are using a very superficial sort of analysis. And I'll explain a little bit about that, okay? The first thing is, and as we discussed at trial, there's a significant number of people drinking fluoridated water in fluoridated communities who have levels of fluoride in their body that are the same or higher than people drinking 1.5 parts per million, okay? And that's because some people drink a lot more water than others. And also some people get more fluoride from other sources, right? And the National Toxicology Program expressed concern on this point in some of its communications with the other federal agencies saying, look, the urinary fluoride levels in the pregnant moms in fluoridated areas of Canada, some of those pregnant moms have higher levels of fluoride in their urine than the communities at 1.5 ppm. That's a concern, right? Mm-hmm. So you have an overlap of exposure between people living in 0.7 ppm areas and people living in 1.5. So that's the first point, okay? Second point, and this is something that we discussed at length at trial, one dose does not fit all with fluoride. And as we've learned with all toxic substances, including fluoride, people respond very differently to one and the same dose. So there are people in the population who are very resistant to the toxic effects of a chemical, right? Mm-hmm. Like you could have shipyard workers exposed to massive amounts of asbestos and they don't develop mesothelioma. Then you have other shipyard workers exposed to the same amount who do develop mesothelioma. So there's an individual susceptibility to toxic substances that's complex, but it's varied. Okay, some people are resistant, some people are vulnerable. And so in our trial, EPA's risk assessment expert, Dr. Stanley Barone, testified and agreed that you need a margin of safety for fluoride of at least 10. What does that mean? What does that mean? It means whatever the hazard level is for fluoride, okay, whatever you think the hazard level is, the NTP thought it was about 1.5 parts per million, okay? Mm. You need to divide that by 10. You need to have a margin of 10 to protect everyone in society, to protect those who are more vulnerable than the average, right? So when you're thinking about, is 1.5 ppm a high level of exposure? Is it relevant to water fluoridation? Keep that concept in mind. This concept of that people vary in their susceptibility to chemicals. Some people are more vulnerable, and you need a margin of safety to protect the more vulnerable. According to EPA's risk assessment expert, in this litigation, you need a factor of 10 to protect the vulnerable.
That means that if you've got putting fluoride in the water, there is no safe level, surely. Because if it was 1.5, that means that the safe level would be 0.1.
That's right. So if you'd like the NTP's hazard level,
you may as well not do it.
Absolutely. I mean, the fact is there is no margin of safety for water fluoridation. There is none. It doesn't exist, okay? So at a hazard level for the for neurotoxicity, okay, of 1.5 parts per million in the water, you have a margin of safety of 10. That brings you down to a safe level of 0.15, okay? We add fluoride to water for fluoridation at 0.7, 0.8. Actually, in New Zealand, a lot of New Zealand communities still add fluoride at about 0.8. This is higher than the United States. That's well above the safe level of 0.15.
But a lot of people frame this as you're taking away my fluoride. They actually want it. But your answer, by the sounds of it, is, well, you can still have it. You have it in your toothpaste.
Absolutely.
You could have it in fluoride tablets even if you want.
Because this is ultimately and always should be a matter of individual choice. Individuals and families should be able to make their own decisions about if and how they want to use fluoride for their oral health. You take fluoride out of the water, that does not in any way limit one's ability or right to get fluoride from the grocery store in the form of toothpaste. So this isn't about banning all fluoride. It's about banning a particular use of fluoride that poses unnecessary risk.
Okay, your thoughts after that, Marie?
That there's absolutely no reason why we should have this in our drinking water whatsoever. And again, I can't help but think to myself that by keeping it in the water, you're harming those that you're claiming to protect. Because again, this sort of idea is an idea of affluence. Because if you're somebody that can afford to drink bottled water because you don't want the fluoride in there, or you can afford to have a water filter put on your house so all that gets filtered out before it comes in, that's all great for you. But those who you're claiming to protect, you mentioned Erin Brockovich before. It's a little bit like that scene in the film where she puts the water across the table to the opposing lawyer and says, "Would you like a glass of water? We had it and bought special from the well in Hinckley." This is what I feel like. In one of the clips that you had from Michael's first part of the interview, there was a woman there sitting, I think she was from the EPA, with a bottled water in front of her. You know, there are so many things. It's all like, do as I, what's the saying? It is...
Do as I say, not as I do.
As I do, yeah.
Yeah, look, we couldn't fit everything into the interview because we just don't have enough time. But I think what I'd really like people to remember is that who you're listening to there, Michael Connett, he's probably the world's foremost expert on the topic of fluoride because he's had to take all of the science around it and look into the entire history, and he's had to be able to take it to court and have all of that information tested.
People need to make sure that they've got choice over what goes into their bodies. It's not that they're saying don't use fluoride to be protective for teeth. They've seen that. They've seen that there is proof for protection topically.
That's one of the things which Michael Connett says. He's not campaigning to get rid of fluoride. If you want your fluoride, you can have it. You can put it tablets in the water and you can drink it, or you can use it as fluoride toothpaste. That's fine. It's just about, like you say, it's about choice. Why make everybody drink it?
Yeah. Yeah, well, exactly. But then that comes all the way back to what Conan O'Brien said, lazy policy. I think both local governments and central governments have gotten away with a lot of lazy policy. And this is the beautiful thing about democracy. Now, for the first time, I think in many, many decades in this country and around the world, the population are starting to ask questions.
Okay, so... if you've been watching this show and you've been following the fluoride debate and you want to do something about it, we do have so much information at our fingertips now. But the way to change things is to keep on talking about it. And Marie, you did an interview with RCR's very own Simon O'Connor, didn't you, about how people can actually do it and do it effectively.
Yeah, indeed. So Simon was the chair on the committee, actually, when they changed the law in 2021. And he copped a lot of flack at that time. So I thought it'd be really interesting to talk to him about that, and also too about the democratic process, how people submit, how you actually effectively put in a submission. And actually, there is so much going on right now. We've just had the gene technology bill submissions close. The COVID inquiry part two submissions are actually still open. How do you actually exercise your democratic right and get your message across effectively so it will actually be most impactful. And Simon had some really interesting things to say.
Let's go have a look at it now.
Joining me now here on RCR 360 is Simon O'Connor from our RCR Talk team. Simon, how are you?
I am doing rather well, better for seeing and hearing you, Marie.
Oh, thank you, Simon. I wanted to get you here for this special RCR 360 on fluoridation because you were the chair for the Select Committee in the 2021 Mandate Fluoridation Bill. Tell us a little bit about that time, being on the Select Committee, and some of the reaction that you got from submitters at that time.
Yeah, it was fascinating. I mean, you could pretty much divide it between, if you will, what the officials and the likes of the Dental Association were saying, and then obviously the fluoride-free New Zealand and others. So two very contrary views. Quite intense, I have to say. People are welcome to their views. I want to really stress that importantly. But it did get quite fraught at times, if I remember rightly, because people felt it so passionately, Marie, and they often expressed it in very passionate ways. And, you know, in many cases, that's fine. But I know in some cases, MPs were getting a bit over it near the end because it was getting quite, intense, not quite abusive, to be blunt, but people were just so intense about it. And MPs didn't quite know how to react.
Did that actually have a negative and actually detrimental effect, do you think, in how this bill was received by those MPs?
Very much so. Yeah, very much so. And look, I've been on other select committees too on other controversial topics. And long and short, people's passion is completely right and understandable. But when it becomes so intense and people are constantly chasing you down the street or emailing every day and saying you're trying to kill them, you know, again, this goes across a range of topics. MPs begin to disengage. They don't find it particularly comfortable.
So then if you want to engage, because we're trying to encourage people to actually become more civically responsible, to get more involved in the whole governance process, regardless of what the issue may be. So if you were wanting to give advice to somebody, if they were wanting to make a submission, whether it to be to their local MP or their local councillor, how do you frame it? How do you think is the best way to catch a fly? Was it with honey or with vinegar?
It's with honey, ultimately. A little bit of vinegar doesn't help. I mean, be passionate. You know, definitely express what you think. But always remember that an MP is just as human as you and I. And so, as I've said before to people, if you're literally going to yell at them or scream at them, and this, again, across a range of issues, you know, how would you react if someone's doing that to you? So generally, engage your local MP. Don't spam every MP around the country. There's no need. Write to your particular MP, express what you're thinking, ask for a meeting, definitely put in your submission to the Select Committee. Again, hit your points, be passionate. But if you will, that haranguing constantly is a surefire way for MPs just to shut down. They just won't, by and large, engage with that. But yeah, be polite, be personal, and just never forget they're human.
So when you're doing a written submission, are they best to do things that are quite general about information that is generally out in the public domain, or is it always better to target and be a little bit more personal on how the legislation and the bill is going to affect them and their immediate family?
I think it's sort of both, actually. I often suggest to people, on your first page of a submission, hit your points really quickly. Say that you do or do not support the bill. Hit your two or three main reasons why, any personal story, but get those big hitting pieces out first. And then in the subsequent pages, go as far or as deep as people want. So bear in mind, as it was with fluoride, if I recall correctly, I mean, you're talking hundreds, not thousands of submissions, and MPs do read them. They won't necessarily read every page between 1 and 50, but they will be reading the first few pages, and if it's engaging, they'll go further. So again, get to the point really quickly and articulately with passion, but not overcooking it. And yeah, share the personal experiences, but get to that quickly. Don't hide it on page 34 and think the MPs will get to it.
Yeah, and sometimes less is actually more, isn't it? So you want to get to it. So, I mean, ideally, you would probably be wanting to get your key points across in no more than 300 or 400 words, I would have thought.
Yeah, I think so. There's no harm in putting a lot of the research, if you will, and supplementary information in. But yeah, if you can get something out within a page, the core message, that is so much more ideal. Remember, as MPs, exceptionally busy, You know, my, your, or someone's submission is one usually of hundreds, if not thousands. And we do try our best to read them, but we're moving, and I certainly for myself, I'm moving at speed. So I'm skimming very fast. And, you know, put it personally, I don't have time to mine, if you will, a long submission for the little gems. I need them presented up front and quickly.
So last week, Winston submitted a bill into the House to revert power back to the councils in regards to fluoridation away from the Director General of Health. They say in everything, including live timing, is everything. What are your thoughts on that?
Look, it is a return to what actually, you know, the centre-right parties have often talked about, localism, as in local community should make that decision. And I think that makes a lot of sense. But I want to underline this point. This is classic Winston, and please, I'm not taking away from what he's doing or his decision. Listeners who think it's great or not, it's just Winston. He just has that ability to sense the change in the tide or in the wind. So this is political, but good on him. That's how our parliament works. And if he feels there's a shift around this topic, all power to him.
Yeah. And have you had a shift around this topic since 2021?
To be honest with you, I just haven't really engaged it in depth. Look, I'm very conscious through the RCR listeners that it's a big, big topic. It's not one of those ones in terms of all the topics that I engage with that I've delved into. So I've sort of remained, I don't know, is the word indifferent? That's probably going to fire people up. I just haven't really delved into it since then. So I probably need to go and read some more.
No, well, there's no harm in that, is there? So look, Simon O'Connor, thank you so much. This has been Simon here with us on RCR 360. Thanks for your time today.
A pleasure.
Marie, one of the things that I think about when I listen to that is that a lot of communication, the effectiveness of it, and I've spent my life doing this actually, is it's about presentation of information in a clear and concise manner. And a lot of the time when we get passionate about something, we go full fire hose and we just blast people with all this information, and it's not in a format which they can digest. That's what I was hearing from Simon. You know, start off with a summation of the key points. And if they really want to read all of the detail that you have, or all of that science and all of that data, put those in the pages afterwards. But keep it really nice and simple up front.
Yeah, exactly. And that's, again, effective with so many of the conversations that we have with people as well. Because if you're wanting to talk to somebody who has believed one thing their entire lives, to actually say there is now a contrary view, it's really confronting for people. Our lawmakers are seeing that right now. So I just think that we need to be mindful of people's points of view. We need to be respectful. We need to approach it with some grace and actually realise that you get a little bit more by luring someone with honey and not vinegar. And so I think it's just doing all of those things, and by having those conversations, engaging with the democratic process, with whether it be local government or central government, and just gently chipping away and just doing it consistently, which is what the likes of Kane and Mary have been doing over just so many years. And you're starting to see that happen now. You're starting to see change happen. And what did they say in the old Pantene ad? It may not happen overnight, but it will happen. We just have to keep going.
And the other thing too, as Michael Connett has pointed out to us tonight on this show, the science is not with community water fluoridation anymore. It's most definitely against it. And I think people, when they're trying to put that point across, you should be confident in that science, in that knowledge. That's all we've got for tonight. Thank you so much, Marie, for joining us. We're going to jump straight to your last rundown for the evening about what else is happening on RCR, and then we'll close out the show. Over to you.
Thanks, Alistair. And remember, if you want to look at more content on the fluoride debate, make sure you check out Alistair's documentary, Fluoride on the Brain, which we've referenced in tonight's show. And also on RCR this week, we've spoken to Mary Byrne from Fluoride Free New Zealand, who joined Paul Brennan to highlight the lack of media coverage on fluoridation and why a public inquiry is so long overdue. Also joining Paul was Whangarei Mayor Vince Kokorulu, who broke down legal pressures councils are facing as they resist government fluoridation orders. He also explained the new private members' bill that could shake up the future of fluoridation laws. Now for the news and tech finance society. Vaz and Iran returned with money talks diving into the interest rates, mortgages and how global financial trends could impact New Zealanders. Ilya Nepelhood from the Offline Club joined Natalie Cutler-Welch to share insights into digital detoxing, the power of unplugging and how phone-free experiences are creating real-world connections. Rural farming and environmental concerns were also on the board this week. In the Rural Report, Jazz Preet and Don explored AgriZero's methane-reducing innovations, including a new molecule from Sweden that can revolutionise emissions reductions. And Perigo is back. Yes, Lindsay, if you love good, unfiltered, razor-sharp political and cultural commentary, Lindsay Perigo is back, and you'll be glad to hear he is here for 2025. With his wickedly delicious sense of humour and fearless takes, he's breaking down the biggest stories in politics, media and free speech. Don't miss the latest. It's all on the app now. And also on the gene technology bill, it's not over. The submission deadline may have passed, but that doesn't mean we stop. Keep the pressure on. Use RCR's Action Tracker resource, spread the word and write to your MPs. These policies don't disappear overnight, and neither will we. And finally, RCR 2.0 is here. If you haven't checked out our new app and website, now is the time. We've made it easier than ever to find content, and our latest channel lets you tap and listen continuously. If you missed Sunday's RCR Tips and Tricks webinar, no worries, the replay is up now. Ali and I walked through everything you need to know and how to get the most out of new RCR 2.0. So if you're not on the new platform, you need to get up to speed and check that out. We want to hear from you, so get your thoughts in on this week's interviews or issues. Text us at 2057 or email inbox@realitycheck.radio. We're listening, reading and watching. That's been the rundown. Plenty to dig into this week. I'll catch you all with the rundown again on next week's show.
Thanks for that, Marie. Look, if I could just finish with this, that what you've heard here tonight from Michael Connett, I think it's the story that should be echoing around this country. And I think it is. Because I saw the crowds that went to see him speak. And it's undeniable that there is a growing appreciation for what he's done. And it's shameful that the New Zealand media ignored what he had to say. Because we're talking about children's brains here. And when you think about it like that, that's a special kind of willful ignorance. So if you can, please share this show and the clips from it and all the interviews we've done on this topic on RCR that you can find on the website and on the app. But also our documentary, Fluoride on the Brain, because in my experience doing these interviews, most of the people who advocate for fluoride and most of the people who are actually responsible for putting the fluoride in our council-controlled water supplies are actually genuinely unaware of the issues with fluoride. And by sharing Michael Connett's knowledge, perhaps they can also see and come to the same conclusion that federal court judge came to in the United States. And perhaps in doing that, we can save a few more children's brains in the process. My name is Alistair Harding, and that's all we have for tonight on RCR 360. See you all again next week. Bye for now.